proclaim the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Shalom and welcome to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. I'm your host, Aaron Broughton, and I want to thank you for joining me on today's program. Perhaps no other time in recent history has captured our attention as the Holocaust during World War II. As we remember over 6 million Jews that were killed by the Nazi regime, we must not forget. I think it is tragic that many are forgetting these horrors today, and we must keep the memories of the dead and the living foremost in our minds. One of the biggest questions concerning the Holocaust is, where was God in all of this? Even though this is not an easy question to answer, we should take comfort in the justice of God. As World War II came to an end, many Nazi war criminals were captured and put on trial for their crimes. Some, however, escaped and became fugitives of justice. Today, we will look at the efforts of Simon Wiesenthal, who tracked down and captured several of these Nazi fugitives. Wiesenthal himself, a Holocaust survivor, is perhaps the most famous Nazi hunter. Let us now turn back the pages of history by looking at the capture of the death camp commandant of Treblinka, Franz Stengel. Born in 1908, Franz Stengel grew up in a strong Catholic family in Austria. He served as a police officer in Austria and joined the Nazi Party as they came to power in 1938 in Austria. Soon after that, he obtained a job as a security officer at a euthanasia facility that was deemed a humanitarian effort that was legal, essential, and secret. Here, over 70,000 mentally disabled and handicapped people, as well as many political prisoners, were killed in what was referred to as mercy killing. It was here where gassing techniques were first practiced. Stengel became a police supervisor and was noted for his organizational skills. These skills, however, would be used in the most heinous way. Stengel was soon promoted by Heinrich Himmler himself as the first commandant of the Sobibor extermination camp. Here, over 100,000 Jews and other prisoners were killed. In 1942, Franz Stengel was then given the job to oversee the Treblinka extermination camp. Treblinka had fallen into disarray under the previous commandant, so Stengel was there to restore order. To see how Stengel did this, listen to this quote by author Robert Wistrick. Quote, "He proved to be a highly efficient and dedicated organizer of mass murder, even receiving an official commendation as the best camp commander in Poland. Always impeccably dressed, he attended the unloading of transports at Treblinka dressed in white riding clothes. Soft voice and polite and friendly, Stengel was no sadist, but took pride and pleasure in his work, running the death camp like clockwork." Unquote. Tragically, Stengel's work led to the death of over 750,000 Jewish people at Treblinka. Due to his dress and demeanor, he was nicknamed White Death by the prisoners. After the war, Stengel was captured by the Americans and later escaped. He fled to Italy without changing his name. There he met with a Roman Catholic bishop who helped him flee to Syria and then to Brazil, where he worked at a Volkswagen plant in Sao Paulo. For years, Franz Stengel remained at large even though he did little to conceal his identity. A warrant for his arrest was finally issued by Austria in 1961. It took another 6 years, though, led by the efforts of Simon Wiesenthal, the famous Nazi hunter, to capture Franz Stengel. The notorious Franz Stengel, the death camp commandant, was arrested near his home and was extradited to Germany, where he stood trial for the deaths of 900,000 people. Even though he maintained that he never had really any intent to kill Jews, to Stengel it was just work. He was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. He died only 6 months later on June 28, 1971 of heart failure. Less than 24 hours before his death, he confessed his guilt in an interview. The capture and trial of Franz Stengel serves to us as a reminder that there is justice, and with that comes healing and unity. This event in reality helped bring Israel and the Jewish people together, as well as give the world a reminder to say, never forget, and also to say, never again. Now, IBJM, also to preserve the memory of the Holocaust, we have a Holocaust Education Day that will be held here at our IBJM headquarters in the greater Chattanooga, Tennessee area. That'll be March 20th of 2015. Invite you to make plans to attend that. Just contact us here for more information. And let's stand for truth during these times. Now, with this in mind, let's now go to our teacher and Jewish believer, Brother Mark Oshman, with today's Bible lesson.
Welcome back to our radio broadcast. We will resume our study about the goodness and the severity of God by looking at the role of divine grace. Paul ended the previous section of Romans chapter 11 by mentioning the Jewish remnant, preserved by what he termed, quote, election of grace, unquote. Paul added, quote, and if by grace, then is it no more of works? Otherwise, grace is no more grace. But if it be of works, then it is no more grace. Otherwise, work is no more work, unquote. Perhaps the most concise statement about the relationship between works and grace appeared in the first chapter of John's Gospel. On that occasion, John wrote that, quote, the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ, unquote. Throughout Paul's writings, the apostle addressed the subject of good works as a means of attaining and maintaining God's favor. In the 10th chapter of Romans, Paul had wrote that, quote, Moses describeth the righteousness which is of the law, that the man which doeth those things shall live by them, unquote. The apostle then stated in Galatians chapter 2 that, quote, by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified, unquote. The righteousness which resulted from keeping the Mosaic law would prove ineffectual for anyone trying to please God. In Romans chapter 7, Paul noted, quote, I had not known sin, but by the law, unquote. Well, the law of Moses could and did show a Jew where he had sinned against God. It did not possess the power to make that Jew righteous in the sight of God. Thus, any attempt by a Jew or Gentile to satisfy God through his own merits would backfire. Indeed, according to Galatians chapter 3, quote, as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them, unquote. James summarized this principle in the second chapter of his epistle by remarking that, quote, whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he is guilty of all, unquote. By contrast, grace involved God granting his favor to those individuals who had done nothing to deserve it. Paul made that point clear in Ephesians chapter 2, when he wrote, quote, by grace are ye saved through faith, and not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, unquote. The apostle followed up in the next verse by remarking that works had nothing to do with the Ephesian Christian standing with God. Grace counteracted the effects of sin. Paul described this operation in the 5th chapter of Romans. He explained that, quote, the law entered that the offense might abound, but where sin abounded, grace did much more abound, unquote. To paraphrase the author of an old hymn, the grace of God is greater than all of human sin. In the 11th chapter of Romans, Paul wrote that God's election of a Jewish remnant came as a result of his grace, not because of any works that the Jewish people had done. In other words, God did not own any debt to the Jewish nation, any debt which would cause him to preserve a portion of them. In fact, Jewish disobedience brought God's judgment upon the nation. Nonetheless, God did not choose the Jews based upon their willingness to keep his commandments. Moses, in the 7th chapter of Deuteronomy, Moses explained why God selected the Jewish people. He declared, quote, the Lord did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, for ye were the fewest of all people. But because the Lord loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your fathers, hath the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondmen, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Unquote. God delivered the Jews from Egyptian bondage because of what he had committed himself to do, not because of what the Jewish people had done, and certainly not because of the righteousness of the Jewish nation. In similar fashion, God will preserve a Jewish remnant by means of his grace, not because of their good works. Going back to Romans chapter 11, Paul transitioned into discussing a new topic. Quote, Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded, unquote. What did Paul mean? Though the Jewish people as a whole had not actively sought for God's grace, God nonetheless extended his favor toward them. Some Jews indeed received Jesus Christ the Savior. The remainder, though, remained in spiritual blindness. Paul discussed the nature of that spiritual blindness in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Quote, "Seeing then that we have such hope, we use great plainness of speech, and not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished. But their minds were blinded, for unto this day remaineth the same veil untaken away in the reading of the Old Testament." Unquote. The apostle would again touch on the matter of spiritual blindness later on in Romans chapter 11. Paul quoted from the Old Testament scriptures to buttress his argument that the Jewish people as a group still abode in spiritual darkness. He cited this Old Testament passage from Isaiah 29, quote, "According as it is written, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear, unto this day," unquote. Going by God's command, Isaiah told the Jewish people, quote, "The Lord hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and hath closed your eyes, the prophets and your rulers, the seers, hath he covered," unquote. The context of that passage described how God's will became concealed to those who had removed their hearts from him. God had something similar to say to the Israelites of Moses' day. According to Deuteronomy chapter 29, Moses exclaimed, quote, "The great temptations which thine eyes have seen, the signs and those great miracles, yet the Lord hath not given you an heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear, unto this day," unquote. Such an attitude by the Jewish nation led to divine judgment upon them for rejecting God's counsel. That assessment explains why God gave these instructions to Isaiah in the 6th chapter of Isaiah's prophecy. God told the prophet to, quote, "Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed," unquote. The spiritual blindness of the Jewish nation still exists today. Pray that God removes that veil from Jewish eyes, allowing them to behold Jesus Christ as their Messiah. After quoting the prophet Isaiah in Romans chapter 11, Paul then cited a passage from Psalm 69. Quote, "David saith, let their table be made a snare, and a trap, and a stumbling block, and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened, that they may not see, and bow down their back alway," unquote. The expressions David employed in the 69th Psalm foreshadowed the sufferings Jesus Christ would experience on the cross. Consider, for example, the previous phrase David used in Psalm 69. Quote, "They gave me also gall for my meat, and in my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink," unquote. These words depicted what actually took place to Jesus Christ on Calvary, according to Matthew chapter 27. Peter applied the imprecations found in Psalm 69, applying them to Judas Iscariot. According to the first chapter of Acts, Peter exclaimed about Judas Iscariot, quote, "Let his habitation be desolate, let no man dwell therein," unquote. In doing so, Peter implicitly characterized Judas Iscariot, the betrayer of Jesus Christ, as being an enemy of God. In Psalm 69, David called for divine retribution to befall his enemies. Their table, designed as a source for their sustenance, would entrap them. The darkening of their eyes and bowing down their backs indicated their impending degradation, as it had done for Samson in Judges chapter 16. Did Paul's application of Psalm 69 indicate that he believed the Jews were indeed enemies of God? No, it didn't. The apostle would clarify his meaning several verses later in Romans 11, when he wrote that, quote, "Concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes, but as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sakes," unquote. The Jewish nation, for the most part, set itself in opposition to God when they rejected Jesus Christ. However, God, in his grace, did not abandon them. Tune in to our next radio broadcast to learn more about the role of the Jewish people in God's redemptive plan.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.